Hi. Welcome to the Friedberg Niagara Conference call for today, April 26th. I'm David Rothberg, and with me is Al Friedberg. Hi, Al. How are you doing?
Good morning, David. How are you?
Fine, thank you. Apologies for the short delay. Sometimes we have fat thumb issues trying to dial in, and sorry to keep you waiting. Just a little bit of housekeeping again. We try and keep the call about 45 minutes. In length, and the format is that essentially I act as an interlocutor to Al using questions that many of our investor clients have sent to us. If during the course of the call you want to send a question to us, happy to try and bring it in. We've got an unusually large number of questions this week. You can send questions to me directly at drothberg@niagaracapital.ca. Or if it's more convenient, you could actually text me at 416-993-4160. That's more convenient, 416-993-4160. Okay, I think that that's it, unless I've forgotten something. We can get started. First question, Al, comes. The first question refers to the rolling corrections that you've discussed in your letter. You talk about them as being a phenomenon that helps the economy. It's a timely question because, of course, we're in the midst of an ugly one now. The market's been down 5 days, and a lot of nerves are frayed. Can you speak about that a bit, please?
Sure. Rolling corrections is more like a concept in, I guess, in economics. It was first proposed by Schumpeter, an economist, an Austrian economist, and quite a while ago. And the idea is that a healthy economy, as it grows, will along the way weed out some of the inefficient industries, inefficient companies, and inefficient sectors. And that is actually a very healthy development in a capitalist system. And we are actually seeing something like this in this recovery. It's slow recovery, but it's proceeding. It's moving along, and we're seeing corrections in many areas. Areas that had excesses at some point are being corrected. We had too many retail shops open in the United States, too many malls open in the United States over the last 20 years. Well, that's correcting now. Okay, and it's Amazon that is probably the proximate cause of that, but it's happening. And so during this recovery, you've had some very serious closures, bankruptcies of companies in the retail sector, malls that are coming empty, restructured for other uses. So rolling corrections are important, and sometimes we get sort of a little we get influenced by seeing these. These are like anecdotal evidence. We get influenced by seeing what's happening in some of these areas, and we think that this is really the entire economy, that something is wrong and that the entire economy is not doing well. We're not able to see the bigger picture, and because they're very dramatic cases, these rolling corrections are very dramatic. I mean, you see, for instance, high price residential New York City is going through now a severe problem, a severe correction, and people who live there and who see it, who see what's happening to stores closing on Fifth Avenue. I'm giving an example because New York City is such a prominent city. Will derive from that an idea that everything is doing poorly, and that there is problems everywhere, and that the economy is slumping. So, I think that it's important to take a detached look, a sort of a perspective, have a wider perspective, and say, look, these are rolling corrections. These are corrections of things that have gone out of line. And the economy is correcting itself, and it's good. It's actually good because we are now moving assets. We're reallocating capital towards more productive and more efficient endeavors. So, in effect, this is what's happening now.
Can you speak about this in terms of the correction that we're seeing in markets? I think the standard narrative, or I wouldn't say standard, but the narrative that's emerging is that markets are responding to, are looking beyond the current spate of very robust earnings to leading economic indicators, which globally seem to have rolled, or I'm speaking about purchasing manager surveys and the like. We're now trapped in a range. The range has been difficult to swallow. As I said at the outset, these last 5 days, the market having been down 5 days in a row for the first time since 2014. And our own position, our own portfolios, I'm talking about both the Asset Allocation Fund and in particular the Global Macro Fund, the latter being more leveraged, having suffered even more so.
Right. So I think, again, I believe that those are incorrect inferences. The overall economy is doing relatively well. This morning we had unemployment claims at a new all-time low, 210,000 to 208,000 people claiming unemployment. But this is incredible because the labor force in the United States has more than doubled in the past 20 years or 25 years or 30 years, and we never had a number like this. So there's practically nobody that wants to work not working. I mean, it's just an incredible thing. The same thing, we've had the durable goods, very, very strong, much stronger than expected. So the economy is doing well, and the global economy is doing relatively well. Maybe we'll leave aside China for a moment. But the global economy is doing well, but we are so impressed. We are so impressed by changes that are taking place in sectors that it colors our overall vision. So, you know, in the market, when you speak about the market, in the market we've had some also rolling corrections. A lot of the excitement that took place in the FANGs, the Facebook and Google and
Amazon,
Microsoft and Apple. Yeah, it's a changing leadership. It's a rotation. They've had a tremendous run. They probably have outpaced the best expectations, and for now they're taking a breather and they're off their highs, and maybe they're off 10 or 15% their highs, but I think they're taking a breather. And by the way, I'm not making a call on these stocks. All I'm saying is that it is a normal procedure that when a bull market is proceeding, you will have rolling corrections along the way. Groups will rotate, and a new leadership will come into this market, and we'll see. We are getting to see new leadership. We are going to see cyclical stocks do better in some cases, or other growth industries do better. It's not an easy thing to do to find these, but generally speaking, and I say this because I say this confidently because I see this from a breadth point of view. The breadth of this market is still good. Most stocks by far are advancing and doing well. Breadth of the market does not follow the weakness that we see in the more visible indices. And so I would say that the stock market is reflecting the economy. We're getting rolling corrections in sectors. We're getting changing leaderships, but that does not mean that the economy is not doing well or that the global economy is not doing well. It is doing well, and incredibly enough, we are doing well with a very low level of inflation. You would expect that at this point, with unemployment the way it is, you'd get very strong inflationary pressures. We are not getting very strong pressures. The wage costs are going up much in a much more subdued way than they have been in the past. And exactly why this is happening, it's a long discussion. I don't think we should talk about it today. But my assessment is, it looks scary, but it's scary because we sometimes concentrate on narrow areas that are very dramatic and they look terrible, but actually the overall picture is good.
So do you not feel then that the negatives that are generally perceived, as to say, trade war risks, political risks, and the possibility that inflation may be a harbinger, the current, or that the little bit of inflation that you see creeping into the economy here and there may be a harbinger of a stagflation that's somewhat similar to the 1970s, a cost push inflation, a bad inflation that could lift bond yields. You don't find that threatening, and let's add to that list a very I wouldn't say so much a dramatic, but a notable narrowing of the yield curve, especially the 2 and 10. How do you incorporate these negatives into this otherwise rosy worldview that you seem to have?
Well, you know, Dave, I discussed this in their last letter. I said that the evils that we see will not kill us. What we see is actually, it is worrisome. I mean, it's clear that trade wars are not a good thing, absolutely not a good thing. It's not so clear that we're going to get an inverted yield curve, and even if we do, it's not clear that that will be a major threat to the economy. We're not really sure. We have some statistical evidence in the past, but that does not mean that's true. And also, we have to understand that the Fed officials are like us. They're no different. They're not gods. They're like human beings, and they were brought up in Wall Street, or they were brought up in academia, and they study and learn the same things that we do. And so they also are aware of the inverted yield curve. The inversion, if the inversion comes, it will only be because the Fed will push short-term rates above where, let's say, the 10-year is. Because they themselves know what the history is of inverted yield curves, it's not likely that they'll do that unless they see some very, very serious excesses in the economy. So I'm not worried about it, about that aspect. I'm not that worried about trade wars, even though that would be a terrible thing. I believe that there will be some negotiations taking place. It looks like NAFTA is going to come to a relatively good end. I don't know if it's good for Mexico, Canada, the United States, but it doesn't look like it's going to explode. I believe the Chinese are too nervous about engaging a full scale trade war, and I think that there will be some give and take. Again, I'm not in favor. I don't think that this should have been done this way, but I don't think it's the end of the world. And so the only thing that it would be the end of the world for this market are credit stresses caused by a very, very defensive Federal Reserve. And the only way the Federal Reserve is going to get defensive and is going to have to act defensive and act aggressively. I mean, defensive meaning that they'll have to do something that they don't want to do. And the only time they're going to have to do something they don't want to do, the only time they're going to have to raise rates in such a way that they're against the wall, is when inflation really rises rapidly or accelerates on the upside. We haven't seen any of that. The 70s was not, just to correct you a little bit, the 70s was not a period of cost push inflation, was a period of demand pull, was a period of rising commodity prices around the world, and strongly rising commodity prices around the world, rising costs, exploding credit and money. We're not seeing that today. We're still not seeing it. I'm not saying we're not going to see it, but we're still not seeing that. And so the Fed is comfortable, very laid back, very much in the narrative is we want to normalize rates, and they should normalize rates. They should go back up to something more like a neutral rate, maybe 2.5% or something of that sort, until inflation rears its head up. And when it does, and it does in a big way, they're going to have to do more. But as long as they don't do that, I don't think that there's a trigger in this market.
What are the proxies for inflation that you're looking at? And I'm assuming that your great fear that if you do see inflation, then you will see a rise in rates, and then you have to be worried about all the credit stresses that are hidden underneath.
Right. That is correct. I believe that the single best indicator of inflationary pressures, and it's not the only one, People are looking at different things. So one of the things that people are looking at is, of course, wages. Another thing people are looking at is services. Hard to measure, but services are a very important factor, especially in the U.S., which is a service economy. But to me, the simplest, most responsive index of inflation is commodity prices. They're very, very sensitive. They will move very quickly, and they will respond very quickly if we have a generalized impulse, a generalized inflationary impulse. And I think that anybody that has a terminal can, Bloomberg terminal, can look at the BCOM, which is an index of 42 commodities, I think, and it's been flat for quite a number of years now. It's true that it made it slow in 2016. I think it went down from like a high of 175 as an index in 2011 to something like 72 in 2016. It's been now around the 88, 90 area. Has been flat, as I say, for now as much as 3 years, or pretty close to 3 years, 2.5 years. So until I get to see that index move up and show me that there is sensitivity to higher prices, we are not going to get inflation in a way that will force the Fed to do anything. I just want to bracket this a little bit and say that neither money growth at the moment in the U.S., money growth, which is growing fairly modestly, it's like somewhere around 3 to 4% per annum in the broader indices, nor what's happening in China, are telling us that there is a serious danger of commodity prices moving up. So I'm right now agnostic. I don't know if it's going to go up. I don't know if it won't. It should. Economies around the world are strong. The U.S. is strong. We are reaching capacity constraints, maybe in some areas, and yet we're not seeing that inflation. So I'm willing to wait. I'm willing to wait before I decide. And by the way, David, if it happens, it will happen, and it will take many months before the Fed actually decides that this is indeed a significant threat. So even if commodity prices are rising today, it may take as much as a year before the Fed reacts and sees the danger. They reacted very, very late in the 70s, very much too late. They reacted years late. And this is what happened. This is why inflation just took off. So it's not impossible that after so many years of calm on the inflation front, that the Fed will say, well, let's give it a chance. We'll wait a little longer. We're not sure. We don't know. And that will take a year. It could take a year and a half. It could take 2 years. So as we stand today, I do not see a major threat to the economy other than geopolitical events. I mean, these things are unpredictable, and if they happen, they could threaten anything. But other than geopolitical events, I don't see any major threat to the economy.
I'm going to circle back to the inflation issue when we talk about gold. But before we do, before we leave off with equities, I'd like to come back to an argument that you've had, you've expressed now for several years. I don't think I'm exaggerating here. And I'm speaking about the equity risk premium. You've argued that equities, the most fundamental argument for being long equities was that there really was no alternative. If you've got now a 10-year at breaking 3%, the competition is different now than it was. At 3%, you're getting a return that's better than the dividend yield, and suddenly there is another game that can be played. How do rising bond yields, or this imagined threshold of 3% having been breached, affect that argument about the equity risk premium? Perhaps actually, asking this question, asking it just to contextualize it. It's part of a question that a client has sent us, and I think for the benefit of some of the investors, a bit of an explanation of what the equity risk premium is might be beneficial.
Okay, the equity risk premium. It really is saying this. If you are an investor, a long-term money investor, and you want to decide, and you have to decide, not you want to, you have to decide where to put your money, fixed income or stocks, and everything else being equal, meaning that the governance is okay, and that the courts work properly, the property rights are well protected, everything else being equal. If you have to decide between those two assets, you're going to have to decide, where do I get the best return? So the equity risk premium says that stocks, because they're more volatile and they're more risky over time, will have to pay in terms of like return more than bonds because they're riskier. But and so over time, we have this premium. We can actually see it historically, right? We can see that over time, stocks did better than bonds. But they did better, and it wasn't free money. It did better because it was riskier. But, you know, over time, of course, this is a different argument, but over time, markets have become inured to this risk in a U.S. economy that, according to Warren Buffett, never, the U.S. economy will never go down into a slump or a slump forever. Just one second, David. So over time, you would think that money managers would say, you know, I'm inclined to buy U.S. securities. I don't want to take the risk of one individual stock. But if I buy a basket of securities, if I buy a portfolio of securities, then I can compare it against bonds. So now that we know what the equity risk premium is, and you want to demand a certain premium for that risk, and over time that risk is diminishing in the perception of participants after 100 years of market history, that risk seems to be diminishing. But let's assume that risk doesn't diminish, and you have to say, okay, what do I get by investing in stocks compared to bonds? In the end, what is that premium? And I made the argument that the only way to compare it properly is to compare it against real return bonds, not nominal bonds, not the 3% that you're quoting, not the 10-year 3% that you're quoting, but the 10-year TIPS. The 10-year TIPS is today yielding about 75 basis points. Okay, that's 3% rate of inflation, 3% interest minus the rate of inflation today, that's 0.75. That's the yield. That's what I can get. And I can, as a return, and know that I'm going to get my principal back. So if I'm a money manager, a real money manager, and I invest money for 50 or 100 years, I'm going to get, I'm using simple, very simplified numbers, I'm going to get 0.75% a year inflation protected. And I use inflation protected because really stocks have a certain kind of inflation protection. Companies have sales and book values that rise with inflation. And then I say, okay, so let me see what I get in stocks. And what I get in stocks today with P ratios the way they are today, I'm getting close to 5% returns, right? It's the inverse of the P ratio. The inverse of the P ratio today, let's say 20, again, simplified. So the return that I get is 5%. So if I can get 5% in stocks and I only get 0.75% in bonds, there's a 4.25% or 4% at least equity risk premium. That's a very large premium to pay for risk. 4% a year in a U.S. economy that over time has done well, we know has done well, it's very diversified, we're not dealing in one sector, we're not just buying Google, we're not buying Amazon, but we're buying a very large group of companies, very creative, very innovative, very dynamic group of companies. That's a very large premium to pay. So my argument is an insurance company or pension fund investing for the long run doesn't really have a meaningful choice. You know, here 4% a year is a lot. Now, remember, the 4% a year is supposed to cover risk. But also remember one more thing. These companies' dividends, and it doesn't matter whether it's reinvested in the business or paid out, but these companies' earnings over time rise by 2% a year. So it's not a difference of 4%. It's a difference of 6%. You add the 2% growth to that 4%. So 6% a year difference, that's too much. Over 5 years, that's an enormous difference.
Well, how does this difference compare to what happened, say, 10 years ago?
I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I don't know what the real rates were. For example, in the late 90s, you had real rates. TIPS were trading at a 3 to 5%, maybe 4% real rate compared to today, 0.75. So there was a much bigger difference than in favor of bonds than it is today. And in addition to everything, we have a Federal Reserve that we know is very conservative, very unlikely to move quickly. There is an asymmetry. We have seen this asymmetry over and over again. It's easier to lower rates than it is to raise rates. When we raise rates, we announce it with a lot of fanfare a year in advance, and it's going to be a quarter of the time. So are real rates really going to go up to 3%?
Right.
It's very hard for me to believe that they will go up to 3%.
Right. I hear. Okay, thank you. I think that's a pretty clear statement. Okay, let's go back now to the inflation issue. You talked about not seeing inflation anywhere. You don't see rising commodities, and yet you have a position in gold, which is both a commodity and a barometer of inflation.
Wait, let me just correct one thing. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I don't say that I don't see inflation anywhere. I see inflation. We see it. I don't see an acceleration in the rate of inflation. That's the danger. We have a 2% rate of inflation going on for a long time. Yeah, go ahead.
So then gold, you don't see accelerating inflation, and your proxy for inflation is commodities. So gold is both a commodity and both a barometer of inflation, and yet you have a pretty substantial position in gold, both the asset allocation fund and in the global macro fund. What's the view there?
It's a good question, and I ask myself the question every morning and every night, and maybe every noontime. I ask myself that question all the time, right? because you're right. You know, the argument is, there's no acceleration in inflation. Commodity prices are not taking off. Why should I be a buyer of gold? So let me just say two things. First of all, if you look at the relation of gold to commodities in the past 10 years, it's actually gone off. It's delinked. Gold prices have done much better than commodity prices. And just a plain chart will show that gold prices have advanced against commodity prices. Of course, the question remains, why? Why should it have been better? But the fact is that somehow gold has not acted fully as a commodity. So I'm going to try to take gold out of the commodity basket for a moment and say there's something else going on. And now the question is, what else is going on? And I'm trying to sort of enter the unconscious of the global market, right? I mean, I can't point definitely for a reason, but I can say that the market may have this in the back of its mind, or it may be happening already. And this is this. Central banks historically, for the last hundreds of years, have held gold in their international reserves as practice. There was a time in which international reserves was composed exclusively by gold, 100% by gold. Over time, that changed, and sometime in the late 70s, early 80s, just to give you a brief history, academics made the argument that one doesn't even need international reserves. And besides that, gold is a sterile asset, doesn't produce any income, so why own any gold? So central banks around the world began to demonetize. And it was a long period of demonetization that followed the spike in gold prices in the late 70s, so that over the 80s and the 90s, there was a tremendous pressure on the price of gold because central banks were demonetizing. Countries like Canada went out completely of their gold holdings. They totally eliminated their gold holdings. The UK, I think, sold more than half. Switzerland even sold more than half. So many countries demonetized. And it somehow made some sense. You know, the academic argument was good. I mean, first of all, you don't really need reserves in a floating rate regime, which is what we have today, a floating rate regime. And secondly, why hold gold when you can hold securities that pay dividends? And this doesn't pay any dividends. Just if anything, you have to pay storage costs. It's kind of annoying. You have to pay storage costs. So, and then there was some kind of an agreement, the Washington Agreement in the late 90s. The idea was, you know, central banks falling all over each other. And when you see that phenomenon, people falling all over each other to sell something, you know that that's about the bottom of the market. The same thing happens on the upside. But they were falling all over each other, who can sell first? And the price was driven down to $300 an ounce. And then they realized that, wait a second, we got to put some order into selling, because if we don't give you laundry tickets, and the number one and number two and number three, if we don't give you tickets, and the order of when to sell, you're going to drive the price down to 5 cents. And so they made an agreement that they couldn't sell more than a certain amount per annum. I don't remember now the number, maybe it's 500 tons a year. That was the number that they agreed. And so you had to register with the BIS, and you had to tell the BIS, I want to sell a certain amount of gold. And so they controlled the sale, and that was the bottom of the gold market. The prices bottomed in late 90s, around $300 an ounce. Interestingly, over the subsequent 5 years, the first few years were taken up completely because there were still central banks selling. And the 500-ton limit, the quota, was taken up. But towards the last part of those 5 years, and certainly in the renewals that took place later, less and less gold was being registered for sale. So central banks had that. Yeah, central banks stopped selling. In fact, they had reached some kind of a desired equilibrium. Then, sometime in 2000, I don't, again, I'm being imprecise here, 2005, 2007, 2008, you start seeing central banks rebuilding gold reserves. And that was an interesting phenomenon. That was something that didn't happen for 25 years or maybe longer. Why was that happening? And so you have to ask yourself the question, did they know something? Did they think that the price would go up or that they knew the price? I think the answer is very simple. As the world, as we see more and more tension, political tension, military tension, tension in the relationship between countries, a push for hegemony in Asia, or any balkanization of the world economy in some sense, getting groups of countries moving apart. It's no longer a U.S. It's no longer a U.S. world, right? The U.S. is no longer the unquestioned leader around the world, and for better or for worse. And so you're getting countries that are rebuilding their gold reserve because they're saying, look, I don't want to be in a conflict with the U.S. and own U.S. treasuries. Right. And China, as an example, has $4 right. trillion dollars of reserves, and they have over $2 trillion of debt, right? The U.S. debt.
Right.
So I believe that what's happening is that there is a slow, and we've seen it in Russia, in Turkey, in China, a slow rebuilding of reserves. And so I think, and if you look, by the way, the level of reserves of these countries is enormous. Reserves have gone up 20-fold in the last 20 years, 20-fold. So if gold were ever regain some of its position of being a significant portion of international reserves, the price would explode, right? If you move from 2% of reserves to 10% of reserves, the price would probably be $5,000 an ounce. So I believe that may be happening. That's all I'm saying. I don't know more than that.
That's a super argument, really. Thank you. We still have questions to put to Albert about Brazil and about Greece and about Tesla. And I also want to ask him something about housing, which hasn't been put hasn't been sent to me by any of the clients, but it's an important position in both the funds and something that deserves some conversation. We've only got 8 minutes left if we want to hold ourselves to the 45-minute mark. For those of you who are going to be listening to this for the first time on a podcast, I'll just say that I think it's important that we put these questions to Albert, and so we may go a little bit over the 45-minute limit. Al, let's scurry to Brazil. Just in broad strokes, what is it about Brazil? There's anxiety about Temer, as there always has been. Currency has been weakening a bit. You've moved from fixed income, largely from fixed income, into banks. Can you speak a bit about Brazil, please?
Okay, muito problema. I hope I said it right in Portuguese, but there's a lot of problems. And Brazil, Brazil went through, as I said many times before, went through a devastating, really horrible depression over a three-year period. One of the most severe depressions in the Western world in the last 100 years. So it was a very painful experience. They had expanded very quickly. The Lula government spend a lot of money, not only spend money directly, but also use national lending banks to lend billions and billions and billions of dollars for development. And this really was a way of spending too. So there was no fiscal order. It was crazy, absolutely crazy. And that came to an end when the Central Bank of Brazil had to. And by the way, I want to just emphasize that was forced to. This is what I expect in the U.S. to happen if we want. If the bears are right, and if the bears want to see a bear market, I don't know why they want to see a bear market, but when they want to see a bear market, they have to picture a central bank being forced to raise rates. That's what happened to Brazil. Brazil raised rates from I don't know, 6 or 6.5% all the way to 14 or 15%, and got the rate of interest above the rate of inflation. And that caused a huge, huge depression. But the good part about it is, during this time that it caused the depression, but we also lowered the inflation rate significantly, much more than they had expected. We went down to as low as 2.7% per annum. That's very good. And the reason why that's good is because it increases the purchasing power of the worker, right? So as much as the worker was affected terribly by the depression, but a good portion of the population was affected favorably by having better purchasing power. At any rate, this took place, and the second thing that took place was there was a tremendous. I'm starting to use this word "tremendous" a lot. I wonder why I'm copying somebody, but okay.
Tremendous is to the investment, to the investing adult, what awesome is to the non-investing millennial.
Okay. That's it. So there was a lot of corruption in Brazil, tremendous amount of corruption. For the last 50 years, we've had more and more corruption. And this government spending and very, very heavy government spending and accentuated that because it also allowed for deals to be made. And so it finally came to an end when a very, very aggressive lawyer, more than a lawyer, he was a judge, an important judge, took the courage to bring down the whole thing. They found the people who did this corruption, hundreds of them, some of them very prominent people, senators and presidents and businessmen. And they were all going to jail. So there's been a rejuvenation of the political system in Brazil. I don't think it's over. There's a lot of people who still haven't gone to jail. But there is something there in the air that says there is a rejuvenation. So politically, Brazil is going in the right direction. Economically, they have cleaned. They have gotten rid of the inefficiencies in the system. they no longer have this big spending that comes by way of loans, billions of dollars of loans to people who paid off government officials. So this has been taken care of. And now we still have problems. Of course we have problems. You know, as I said, not everybody went to jail. And also, as I said, there's still candidates now for the upcoming election in October that keep speaking and saying stupid things. There's still people who want to vote. Apparently, the Lula in jail has today more voter appeal than any other candidate. So you can see that what demagoguery can do. He still would win an election today, most probably, but it likely is that he won't run because he's in jail. So we don't have good candidates. We don't have great candidates. But, you know, I believe that we're going to end up with a center, maybe left of center or maybe center type candidate, but with things in better order. We have spending limits for the next 20 years, and now we're going to look very seriously at trying to do something about pension reform. Temer tried to do that. He couldn't get enough of a quorum because the elections were coming up already. It was politically sensitive. I believe that we will do that too. So Brazil is uniquely set up for a very strong upswing. It is by far the most exciting of the emerging markets, because of the fact that it's from a cyclical point of view alone, it's better, because it went through a much deeper recession than the other emerging markets. The metrics in Brazil are good. If you realize that these metrics are based on cyclically low earnings, I think that that's pretty good. You know, Brazil's P ratios are like, for instance, you have dividend yields of 2.8%, and the forward P is 17.7 times. I recently got those numbers from one of our brokers in Brazil. 17.7, based on very, very weak earnings still, just coming off the bottom. Right? It can't compare to the 17.7 in the U.S., where we've had 9 years of recovery.
Right.
So that's cheap. That's fairly cheap. So I think that Brazil is cheap. I think the banks in Brazil are very solid. They make a lot of money. Their rate of return on capital is much, much higher. The rate of return on assets and on equity is much, much higher than the rate of return in the U.S. banks. And they deserve to be trading at much higher price books and price earnings. So I believe that Brazil is the best emerging market play. It's not that we are looking for emerging market exposure. I don't think that the listener should get that impression. We're not looking for emerging market exposure. That's something that we don't do. We look for what's the best investment around. It happens to me that Brazil is, to us, one of the best investments around.
Let's talk about banks, let's take this opportunity to move to Greek banks. Greek banks, your Brazilian banks, if I'm not mistaken, are trading at about 1.5 times book, or is it even higher than that?
No, about 2.1.
2 times book. Greek banks are trading at 0.4, 0.5 times book, somewhere in that neighborhood?
Yeah, between 0.3 and 0.4.
0.3 and 0.4. So on a relative basis, they're very, very cheap. They kind of titillated in the sense that they refused to go down despite a tremendous amount of tremendous, especially at the outset when we put the trade on. Now, however, what they don't do is go up. Today the ECB spoke. I don't know what their what they did with interest rates yet. But how do you see that? Like, what, is this something that where's the catalyst there? I guess that might be the question. Where is the catalyst? What is ultimately going to vindicate this trade?
Yeah, that's the important word, catalyst. You know, that's the important word, catalyst, because the conditions are set for Greek banks to do well. First of all, once again, we now have banks allowed to sell foreclosed property. For 5 years or 6 years, they were not allowed to sell foreclosed properties. Imagine banks had almost all their assets loaned out to people who were not paying them. Some of them were not paying them strategically because they thought the bank would fail, so why pay? People who had money. And they were not allowed to foreclose a property. So what can you expect? I mean, every lender in the world would go bankrupt. But for the past year, new legislation was passed, despite the fact that it was a socialist government. They just had to do it under pressure against some creditors. And we now have weekly electronic auctions, and they're growing larger and larger. And now people who are strategically defaulting are starting to come back to the banks and saying, look, let me make a settlement with you. Let me pay. So that's great. That's great. That's going to help the banks. There's also a very strong tourist sector in Greece. Prices have gone down. There's been an adjustment, a downward adjustment of prices, even though they never devalued, but pressures have gone down in prices. And so there's a boom in tourism, and many of the banks, some of the banks anyway, are engaged in tourist-related loans. And so, yesterday, I can't remember, there was a chart in the Wall Street Journal showing how deep the recession in Greece was. Brazil and Greece were the two countries that suffered the most from recession. And the Greek recession barely touched bottom recently after 42 quarters of going down. That's a lot of quarters. It's a lot of time. And down maybe almost 30%. The GDP is down almost 30%. So there's a good recovery coming. What's the catalyst? Well, the catalyst is the catalyst is a better economy. Second catalyst is the fact that the IMF and the creditors are basically saying, okay, you've done what you had to do. I think we're going to give you a clean bill of health. It's only a matter of another month or two. There was some fear that that the banks would be forced to recapitalize again to put them even a stronger foundation. It seems now that they will not, or if they will, it will be very minor. It looks like they are now fairly well capitalized. So, you know, I can't tell you for sure when, but I can see this. In recent weeks, Greek banks have begun to do better than their other European banks.
Right.
We watched that very closely, and there's been a major improvement of the Greek bank performance compared to European banks.
Okay, Tesla. I'm going to leave the home builders to the end and the penultimate, the most dramatic, Tesla. Not so much. I think the question isn't so much where you stand on this I think overly debated stock, but why it is that you've traded this one individual stock when, as a matter of policy, you tended to be averse to that and wanted to play themes in a much more diversified way. So that, for example, Brazil is a theme and Greece is a theme, but it's expressed in a number of different banks with positions in a number of different banks in both instances. Home builders, likewise, it's a position that you have in many different home builders via an ETF. But in this particular case, you have one specific, very focused trade. What's the deal here?
Well, this policy that we have is not a policy where we say that we promise that that's the case. That will be the rule. It's sort of self-imposed because we strongly believe, that markets are quite efficient when it comes to individual selection of stocks, and it's very hard for us to be able to be very hard almost for anybody to beat indices. And we've seen this. We've seen that active managers are not able to consistently beat passive indices. So, you know, we have said to ourselves that the odds are against us if we wanted to choose something. In Tesla's case, I find that it's a little different because it is a very emotionally laden stock. There's a lot of people who are mesmerized by Elon Musk. A lot of people mesmerized by the beauty of the design. But nonetheless, Tesla's not able to produce the cars they want to produce. They've had to continuously reduce the production numbers. and they don't seem to be able to make the production numbers. In the meantime, they have lost ground because there's many, many other producers, many other manufacturers that are coming to this market. And some of them look a little worse, and some look a little better, and some of them have other features. Asian car makers, Nissan and Chinese, and General Motors has got a very successful Bolt that sells much more, many more cars than Tesla's car. It's going to be overwhelmed by the other producers. So we think that that emotional factor is built into the price is much too much of a premium. And in addition to that, the company owes, I think, $10 billion directly, maybe another $10 billion in other types of debt. They're cash flow negative. It's only a question of time before they have to come back to the market, and it's hard to come back to the market again now. It's going to affect the prices a lot. It's going to affect stock prices a lot. If they can sell any stock, it's going to affect them. And it's hard for them to borrow more. I mean, their debt is trading at junk levels. Tesla, I think, is an exception. And having said that, what we did is we went short by way of options, by way of put options. We did not go short outright because we still believe that there's too much risk in being short an individual stock. Just like there's too much risk being long an individual stock, there's too much risk being short an individual stock. So we did it by way of options. Our exposure is not great. If the bet doesn't pay off, we may lose, 1 or 2% of net asset value.
Okay, thanks. Let's end it with a bang. And the biggest trade that you've got on, the trade that you've been most committed to, is home builders. And I don't think that we need to belabor the secular reasoning behind the trade. But I think that it's worth noting that if on one hand you're going to argue that wages are not increasing in some way that's mysterious, in other words, that component of inflation is not a threat, and if at the same time the cost of a home is going up, both by virtue of diminished supply, but now by mortgage costs that have gone up by about 45 or 50 basis points in the past 30 days, where do you stand in terms of these new dynamics? Like, that's the issue.
Okay, so let me use another Trumpian one. There's a tremendous shortage of housing in the United States. Right? Okay, we haven't built in 10 years. And so there's at least a shortage of 1.5 million starts, 1.5 million units that has to be made up. And so the shortage is what's causing prices to go up. They are going up about 0.5% a month. It is interesting because, you know, as prices go up, you would deter buyers. But nevertheless, we have good demand, very good demand. Housing sales have been good, moving up. New home sales and existing home sales have had some very good numbers lately. Housing starts are rising, not in a straight line, but they keep rising, keep making new highs in the recovery. So I think that the cycle is intact. Interest rates have gone up maybe 50 or 80 basis points in the last year in the mortgage end, and yet we're still seeing increases in mortgages outstanding to buy homes, to purchase mortgages. I think that we are about 10 to 12% up year over year. And that's interesting because rates are higher. And it's becoming more and more difficult to carry these homes at the higher rates, given the prices. And yet it's happening. And so I can't tell you when we get to the point where we choke off the demand. I cannot tell you that. But I guess the shortage is large enough that it may take some time before that happens. The market is waiting for more supply. And these firms like DHI today, this morning, Horton, and yesterday, Pulte, showed very, very good earnings, excellent earnings, an excellent backlog of orders. And the market keeps betting against them, saying, oh, this is going to have to end because prices are too high and because the incomes are, people can't make it with their incomes that they have, or mortgage rates are too high. But it's not happening. And from a comparative point of view, we're still better off today than we were in 2005. In 2006, this is before we still had a fairly large rise in sales. The situation, of course, is much worse than then because we have less supply, less inventory. I believe that we're still in the mid cycle when it comes to housing. We're probably mid cycle, and when you start seeing prices level, is when you know that production is starting to catch up with demand. And we watch prices, okay? So prices for us is very important. And that's it. The story, I think, remains a very good story, an excellent story.
Okay, well, good. All right, thank you very much for the time. We went a little bit over time today, but I think it was worth it. For those of you who want to catch up further, we're in the office today. You can call the Friedberg guys at 416-364-2700. You can call me on my mobile, 416-993-4160, or send us an email. These emails or these podcast of these of this conversation is going to be posted, as are all of them, by Eddie on the Niagara site and on the Friedberg site. And with that, wish you guys a good day, and use the opportunity to wish Al a good trading day and a good trading quarter. Thanks for your time, Al.
Thank you, David. Bye-bye.
Okay, be well. Bye-bye.